You remember about 6 years ago when this huge story broke and carried itself across the country, did tons of damage, cities were burned. It was the death of George Floyd by the accused hands of Officer Derek Chauvin. And so I think a lot of us are still confused about what happened with that. We knew that passions were high. And so, interestingly enough, I heard a briefing just this week by an investigative attorney who's tracked everything, all the details, the evidence, and has written a book called American Scapegoat, How a Corrupt Justice System Sacrificed Derek Chauvin to the Mob. And he says, 6 years ago today, George Floyd died while in custody of Minneapolis beat cop Derek Chauvin, sparking the most destructive riots in our nation's history and becoming the pretext for an era of mass political hysteria that threatened to rip apart the very fabric of American life. Cities burned. Floyd's body was paraded around in a gold casket. Every institution was made to bend the knee to BLM. Ordinary white Americans, represented by the person of Derek Chauvin, were called to account for three centuries of racial grievance. So the narrative was that an innocent black man had been killed by a racist white cop. And for America to atone for its original sins, that racist white cop had to pay the price. Well, what are the details of this? What actually happened? That's what we're going to be talking about on today's edition. But first, well, we talk about how to save babies all the time and their mothers, because preborn focuses on the mom and the dad, if you'll come and talk to them, because they actually provide ultrasound photos or images of the baby in the womb. And it's amazing. It's so powerful. You know, even if it's not your baby and you see that, it's just an amazing, really to me, a sign of the existence of God and his handiwork. Because how in the world can you explain the intricacies, the development in the gestational period of babies to have, you know, fingers sucking and little eyes and a little cute nose? And you can sometimes even already see that the baby looks like a person, the mother or the father or grandmother or something. And it's very moving. And so what they do is powerful. And so we want to give them a shout out all the time. And they help support this show. That's the least important thing I want to tell you. But I'm grateful that they do, because I'm so grateful they're our partners. It's very important to me to save lives. I felt that way for, you know, since I even became aware of abortion when I was 21. It was shocking to me. So if you want to help Preborn provide those ultrasounds, it's $28 for one ultrasound. Go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy and make your most generous donation. All right, now this one is a barn burner. It really is. It's just a fascinating discussion. So you might want to take some notes. I really do suggest that, because you're going to want to tell people about this. But while you're getting your pencil on paper, I'll pause for that. Stay tuned for this edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness, that we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice, not social justice, but God's justice, what's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
Not moving.
I'm not gonna do nothing.
Put your hands behind your back then.
Face at the
floor. Hey, you come back. Stay in the car.
Stop resisting, man.
Yes, you are.
Stand up.
Please, please, man.
Stand up for me. Stand up.
Oh, it's so bad, man. I didn't do none of this wrong, man.
Come on, walk with me. Walk with me. Walk with me.
My feet, man.
Stand up.
Why are you doing me like this?
Stand up.
Stop.
Come on.
I don't want to stop to
the We're trying to get out of the street here so you don't get hit by a car. Take a seat. Sit down for me.
Thank you, man. Thank you, Ms. Lowe.
Sit down.
Thank you, man. God.
Sit all the way down.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I will. Hey, man. Please. Please, man.
You got an ID on you?
I got one at home.
All right, what's your name?
George.
George?
George Perry Floyd. I'm like, I don't know what's going on. Man, that's it.
Spell it for me.
G-E-O.
Yep.
R-G-E.
Last name?
Floyd. Hello, man. F-L-O-Y-D.
F-L-O-Y-D?
Yes.
Date of birth?
And as of October 14th.
October 14th?
73. Man, I got shot last night. Hey, man.
Is you mind doing me a favor? Just run this back for me.
That was the
George Floyd. Thank you.
Man, you looking so I don't want no problem. I ain't gonna do nothing.
Man, you know why we're here?
Why?
We're here because it sounds like you gave a fake bill to the individuals in there.
Yeah.
You understand that?
Yes.
And you know why we pulled you out of the car? Because you was not listening to anything we told you.
Right. Now I know what was going on.
You listen to us and we will tell you what's going on, all right? When you're moving around like that, that makes us think way more is going on than we need to know.
So that's how it started about, 6 years ago? That was the Derek Chauvin trial, the riots in Minneapolis. And that was the exchange between, that's part of it. The exchange between the police of Minneapolis and George Floyd as they were trying to arrest him. Well, that was a very confusing time for many of us because we saw those riots. Minneapolis just burned. It just burned. And we hadn't seen anything quite like that before. That was the worst kind of rioting. And it went on and on and on. And out of that came Black Lives Matter. And we're still paying the price for a lot of the things that were started at that riot. And the death of George Floyd that happened after Derek Chauvin, the policeman, put his knee on George's neck. Now, we're going to talk about that because if you're like me, you wonder, well, what happened? I mean, really, what happened? Derek Chauvin was convicted of murder, and we'll talk with our next guest about where that stands. But today, T.J. Harker is joining us. He's a former federal state prosecutor for 11 years, state and federal. He investigated and tried national fraud and espionage cases. He won a National Case of the Year Award in 2022. Now, today he's a general counsel of a Tennessee-based company. His writing appears in The American Mind, The Federalist Chronicles, Man's World, Blaze, and elsewhere. He writes at Substack on Amicus Republicae, I guess it is. Amicus, nice little Latin spelling. Amicus Republicae and American Scapegoat, that's the book, is his first book. It's American Scapegoat, How a Corrupt Justice System Sacrificed Derek Chauvin to the Mob. And so with that, we want to say hi to TJ. Hey, TJ, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, great. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we all watched this, but we didn't all rush out and write a book. So my question to you is, what was the catalyst that made you want to write a book and investigate what was happening there on that day in Minneapolis?
Now, that's a great question, Sandy. And, you know, the American criminal justice system handles several million felonies per year. Most of those are at the state and local levels, and several hundred thousand of them are at the felony level or at the federal level. And most of the time, the prosecution gets it right. But every year, of course, in a system that's as big as ours, some of them go wrong. And the ones that go wrong are usually not noteworthy. But in this case, this was noteworthy because of all the political events that followed on from the death of George Floyd and then the subsequent prosecution of the four officers who responded to the scene. There were actually five officers. Four of them were prosecuted, and the lead officer there was Derek Chauvin. But the thing that made this interesting is perfectly encapsulated by what the Reverend Al Sharpton said when the trial of Derek Chauvin began. And he said, and I quote, that Chauvin might be in the courtroom, but America is on trial. And he was right about that. There was a political agenda that went along with the prosecution of Derek Chauvin. And implicit in the trial of Derek Chauvin was their claim that America is a systemically racist and evil country, that its legal system is corrupt, that its criminal justice system is biased and corrupt. And all of that, all of those assertions were implicitly associated with the trial of Derek Chauvin, just as Al Sharpton said they were. So that's what made me want to investigate and look into this case to see if the facts, as the prosecution and the media alleged regarding Derek Chauvin, were accurate, on the assumption that if those facts were false, then it would be easier to convince Americans who might otherwise accept the political narrative that went with that, that the narrative itself is also false.
You know, bear with me a sec, and I want to set this question up for you, because when I was on radio in Chicago, I had a very large black audience, and we had a great time. I mean, I hate it. So it's like you have to say, I'm not prejudiced. I have black friends that are people, but I'm not. I'm not. I've learned a lot, and I do have a lot of black friends. So I had a woman come in once a month to talk to me about racial issues. She was a PhD from Harvard. Brenda Verner was her name. And we would just talk about all the hard things. I mean, we had hard conversations, and my callers did too. I mean, we just really, I believe if you really respect people, you speak what you really think instead of trying to pretend you're something that you're not. So we'd have, like I said, hard conversations. So when this happened, when we were on the air, it was the day that O.J. Simpson's verdict came in. And I'll never forget this because I really trusted her, and I think she trusted me. And when I asked her on the air if she believed that O.J. Simpson was guilty, she said, no, he wasn't guilty. And I just sent shockwaves through my back, because I don't know how you could say that. But Brenda had a very, you know, she had a bias, I believe. Did I say she was black? I think I did. And so my question for you is, when I saw Derek Chauvin and George Floyd and saw what I did see, I did sympathize or put my support, even if I didn't say it, behind Derek Chauvin, because he was a law enforcement officer, and just all I was hearing, and it just seemed like over the top. So he was my person that I felt like I should defend. But I didn't know all the evidence. So this is my question to you. Did you have to fight your own preconceived notions about what the truth was about that? Was that a hard thing?
You know, well, first of all, I agree with your premise there that we all have our priors, our biases that we need to account for. In this particular case, I didn't have a prior when it came to arrests or black or white, not because I'm walking on water here, I'm not, but rather because this just seemed to me as a prosecutor to be an ordinary arrest. It didn't, you know, there wasn't a racial component to it, because officers can be black and white, and, you know, defendants can be black and white. The thing that I think really sets this case apart was that it was videoed and immediately broadcast across the world. And this is why I think most people have a bias against Officer Chauvin. It has to do with the fact that most people are very unfamiliar with what I call radical and explosive violence. And so when they see even a little bit of force, for example, using a knee to restrain a subject on the ground, that to them is sort of shocking. The closest most people have ever gotten to violence is, you know, maybe they almost got into a fight in high school. But there are two exceptions to this, and the first is people who've seen combat, and the second is, you know, officers of the law, beat cops, special agents, and so forth. And a half exception will be made for prosecutors who have prosecuted some violent crime and have indirectly seen what is, you know, considered reasonable force. And I had done that. Now, I don't have experience in combat, and I was not a law enforcement officer, but I was a prosecutor, and although I handled espionage and white-collar crimes for the most part, I did prosecute violent crimes, and I also handled use of force reviews. And so to answer your question, I think the reason that most people saw something that they thought was inappropriate here is simply because they do not understand how dangerous an ordinary arrest and how quickly an ordinary arrest can become wildly dangerous in just a matter of seconds. And in this case, you know, the portion of the video or audio that you played for your audience at the beginning of this interview was really just the first few minutes while George Floyd had recently ingested fentanyl. It was after that where he became much more aggressive and actually, while handcuffed, physically overpowered three full-grown men. So consider that. This man who's 6'4", 230 or 240 pounds, under the influence of narcotics, has a criminal history, was able to overpower three full-grown officers while he was handcuffed. And, you know, that's the type of thing that cops have to deal with all the time. They know that a situation that seems like it's under control only seems that way, and that very quickly the facts can change. Once you've normalized yourself to that, this looks like a regular arrest. And, you know, I don't want to ramble on too long without giving you a chance to ask questions, but suffice it to say that one of the two major issues in the trial of Derek Chauvin was the use of force reasonable?
Well, you know, to defend your position, my husband was a prosecutor in Chicago at Cook County for a number of years, and then he went into the FBI. And, you know, I can't even remember which riot this was. It must have been Minneapolis over ICE agents when they had this agitator who the police shot, you know, and that altercation. I can't go into all that, but you know, I bet you remember. He's like carrying a gun in his belt, and they were trying to interrupt an arrest, and anyway, he ended up being shot, and people thought that looked terrible. And Bruce was trying to explain. I had him do it on the show. You don't understand the protocols. You don't understand what police have to do. They do have to use force. And they don't always know everything in that moment like we know later. And so people don't understand that. I think that's a very good point, and I'm glad you said that. So just let me ask you some general questions here. Was George Floyd a criminal? What was his criminal past? I mean, in that day, was it just simply using a forged bill? Or what was his criminal history, if there was one?
Yeah, so on that particular day, and I would like to return to the use of force question at some point, but on that particular day, the only thing that led to the police being called in the first place, and incidentally, the first two officers that responded were Officer Thomas Lane and Alexander Kung. Alexander Kung is a half black man. So Chauvin was not actually one of the first two officers to respond. But he had passed a counterfeit $20 bill. The store clerks of a local mart called Cup Foods had attempted to recover real money from Floyd. Floyd had refused, and so he was called out for that reason. And when officers approached the car, Floyd was acting furtively. He wasn't showing his hands. He was reaching down into the sort of below the seat compartment for about 26 seconds, causing Officer Lane to draw his firearm because obviously he was in imminent danger there. But that's the reason they called him. Now, once they looked him up, they realized he also had a criminal background. Floyd, you know, he was a criminal. This is not the most egregious criminal that police encounter, but he had a history of some violent crime, and he had a history of drug use, and you know, he's the type of guy that you would expect to encounter in Blood's territory, which is exactly where 38th in Chicago was. The street corner in Minneapolis happened to be gang's territory, and Floyd was in that area. Now, it's not clear that he was a gang member, but that's a known gang area.
Well, I did watch a lot of that video. It was very interesting to me because I wanted myself to I didn't do that, you know, when it first came out. And I think it would be very insightful for people to watch. The full thing is actually available online, and it's interesting. Well, okay, so Derek Chauvin, what do we know about? He's the one that actually ended up taking the hit for this. I mean, he was the one who, he's the only one that went to prison, right?
No, he got the longest sentence, but four officers ended up going to prison and serving from anywhere from 2.5 years to 5.5 years. The last one to get released was Officer Tu Tao of Hmong descent. He was released last November. When he got out, incidentally, he made a comment. He was still defiant, maintaining his innocence, rightly so. And he gave an interview in which he said, but for the fact that Derek Chauvin was born white, we would all still be patrolling the streets of Minneapolis. And my research on this book is consistent with that conclusion.
Wow. Well, it's just amazing. So we were told that Derek Chauvin, that George Floyd was suffocated to death by Derek Chauvin's knee on his neck. Now, I know this is a huge topic, and I heard you give a briefing last week explaining all of this. Can you, in a nutshell, tell us why you know that was not the cause of his death.
Yeah, yes, it is a complicated issue, as you have pointed out. And we all, everybody in the world saw that four-minute video, the one that was posted to Facebook late on the evening of May 25th, 2020, by a woman named Darnella Frazier. That video began several minutes after George Floyd was already placed on the ground. And as I said, you know, when you saw that video, what you saw was a man, Derek Chauvin, and some other officers, with his knee on the neck area of George Floyd. You also had another fact. George Floyd was saying, "I can't breathe." And so you as a viewer have these two facts, and they're put together in a nice little package for you by a media that, you know, obviously in retrospect, we now know had an agenda. And that the way they tied that all together was with the narrative that the white man killed the black man, which on its face is consistent with the facts that you saw. If you watched that video, you saw a knee on the neck. You saw the man saying, "I can't breathe." And then you had the media saying it was the knee on the neck that caused the man to say, "I can't breathe." And if you've got other things to do with your life, like we all do, you know, we've got chores and errands and responsibilities and got to do these things, then we don't have any more time to pay attention to this. That prepackaged narrative makes sense and you can move on. But the problem is that if you are a prosecutor, vague media-driven generalities like "the knee killed the man" are not sufficient. You must actually have an explanation for the cause of death. How specifically did the knee on George Floyd's neck cause him to die? And so prosecutors here had lots and lots of choices they could have picked from. What I mean is, if you want to explain George Floyd's death, they had the medical examiner's autopsy that showed a lethal concentration of fentanyl. They showed that George Floyd had severe arteriosclerotic heart disease, narrowing of the major coronary arteries of in excess of 90% in one case, and sufficient to cause sudden death, as multiple witnesses testified. He was also succumbing to something called excited delirium, which results in a buildup of acid in the blood and organ failure. And there were other things that contributed to his death. But the problem with those explanations is that none of them involve Derek Chauvin. The only two that involve Derek Chauvin are the ones that involve his left knee. And that left knee, as everybody remembers, was placed on George Floyd's neck. So prosecutors ignored all the evidence of fentanyl ingestion, the fact that George Floyd had a history of fentanyl use, the fact that he had overdosed only 2 months earlier on fentanyl, the fact that he was suffering from excited delirium, the fact that he had severe heart disease that could cause sudden death. They ignored all of that. And I'm just touching the tip of the iceberg here. And instead, they went to what they wanted to find, which was that Derek Chauvin's knee killed George Floyd, which brings me back full circle to where I began. There, you only have two possible explanations. Either Derek Chauvin's knee was blocking George Floyd's windpipe by compressing it, meaning preventing you from, or him, George Floyd, from breathing in air by blocking the throat, by blocking the windpipe. That's called, let's just call that, for simplicity's sake, an air choke. That's option number one. Option number two is that Derek Chauvin was not using his knee to block the windpipe, but instead was compressing the carotid artery of George Floyd, thereby preventing the flow of blood to George Floyd's brain. Without blood in George Floyd's brain, there would be no oxygen in the brain. Without oxygen in the brain, George Floyd would die. Those are the reason I say these are the only two options is because this is what the medical evidence from the state's own witnesses clearly established. You have only two options: air choke, which is compression of the throat, and blood choke, which is compression of the carotid arteries. So to bring this full circle, the prosecution picked blood choke. And the reason they picked blood choke was because from the very day the autopsy was completed, which was May 26, 2020, Chief Medical Examiner Andrew Baker told the prosecutors, after conducting an extremely detailed autopsy, that there was no evidence of an air choke. He called it mechanical asphyxiation. He had dissected George Floyd's neck, and he found no bruising. He found no petechiae, which are little burst blood vessels. He found no damage to what he called the laryngeal structures. Those are the little pieces of soft tissue like the hypopharynx and larynx and so forth inside the throat. So there was no evidence that there was enough force applied to George Floyd's neck to compress his windpipe. And Dr. Andrew Baker told the prosecutors, you can't compress somebody's windpipe by putting your knee on the back of their neck, because the spine and this big ligament on the back of your neck, which we can all feel if we just reach and touch the back of our neck with the palm of our hand, it's a very powerful ligament called the nuchal ligament. You can't compress the windpipe from the back because the spinal cord and the nuchal ligament protect the soft structures on the front of the throat. So they went with blood choke, which is compression of the carotid arteries. And the reason they went with that is because it doesn't take a lot of force and won't leave evidence of injury on the autopsy if you just compress somebody's carotid artery. You can literally take your index finger and compress your own carotid artery. And if you press with enough force, you could stop the flow of blood up to your brain by compressing your carotid artery. So the prosecution picked that. And to summarize it all, what they hadn't realized and what they did not realize between May 26th, the day after Floyd died, and about the fourth day of trial, 9 months later in April of 2021, when they realized in the middle of trial, is that you cannot actually kill somebody by compressing only one of their carotid arteries. You have to compress both, because the other one, the other carotid artery that is uncompressed, will make up the difference in blood flow through a process called collateral flow. And the prosecution, because they were so heedless of the facts and so intent on advancing a politically driven prosecution, not only did they not realize this, it hadn't even occurred to them until the fourth day of trial. And this was one of the most stunning turn of events I'd ever seen in a trial, when the prosecution realized and then had to functionally concede, because all of their experts were cross-examined on this point, that Derek Chauvin did not kill George Floyd by using a blood choke, even though that's exactly what they had been saying for the last 10 months.
Okay,
so that's a lot. That's the simplest explanation I can do, though.
No, that was great. That was great. Now, here's the thing to me that was amazing. You've mentioned Dr. Andrew Baker, the medical examiner, and he told them he would not bend. They tried, as I recall, to get him to change things, make it a little different. And he refused. He just kept saying no. He wasn't killed by Derek Chauvin. So what happened next? Because I think this is really important to the story.
Yeah. So, when you say next, do you mean back in May after prosecutors tried to meet with Dr. Baker, or do you mean in the trial?
Oh, well, because I don't know all the details. I was thinking of Dr. Mitchell's involvement.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So what happened was, Andrew Baker, who... But by the way, your audience should know that Dr. Andrew Baker is an extremely accomplished medical examiner. He was very thorough in his autopsy, and he not only documented all the things that he did find, which included things like bruises and scratches and cuts on George Floyd's body, which resulted from the struggle, but also the things that he did not find, which Dr. Baker called the pertinent negatives. And he described that as places where you would expect to find evidence if a particular cause of death were accurate. And so there were pertinent negatives in the neck and throat area, meaning there was no evidence there suggesting that any cause of death involving the neck was wrong. Dr. Baker tentatively found his preliminary cause of death was something called cardiopulmonary arrest, complicating law enforcement subdual and restraint. That's a lot. What that basically means is that George Floyd's heart and lungs stopped working because of the exertion associated with being arrested. Basically, he engaged in active physical aggression, which caused his heart rate to accelerate. His heart couldn't handle that because he already had an enlarged heart and severe arteriosclerotic heart disease. He had also taken methamphetamine, which is a vasoconstrictor, meaning it restricts the flow of blood even further, even though George's primary arteries were 90% restricted already. The struggle then released adrenaline, which is a further vasoconstrictor. So at this point, basically, it's like a needle that George Floyd's heart is attempting to pass blood through, and all of his organs are starting to fail because he can't get enough blood. That's what Dr. Baker said originally. And then the prosecutors file their original complaint. I'm skipping a little bit of the story, but they file their initial complaint against Derek Chauvin, and they charge him with third-degree murder. Now, I should say that the prosecutor that charged Derek Chauvin with third-degree murder was later removed from the case for misconduct, so we should come back to that. But he's charged with third-degree manslaughter. I said murder. I meant to say manslaughter. And in that complaint, which is publicly filed, you can see because the prosecutors quoted Andrew Baker, and they said that Andrew Baker found that George Floyd died of cardiopulmonary arrest while being arrested, and there was no evidence of mechanical asphyxiation. So there's a man in Washington, D.C. named Roger Mitchell. Roger Mitchell is a doctor. He happens to be, at the time, the chief medical examiner for Washington, D.C. He's a black man. He seems to have left-wing proclivities, but it was, you know, he was unwilling to comment to me on my multiple attempts to reach him as part of the book, so I did my public research. But everything I'm about to say is factually based in the prosecution's reports and other reports filed into court pleadings. Dr. Mitchell read the criminal complaint and saw that it did not include the phrase "and neck compression" as part of the cause. Okay, remember, why would prosecutors and the activists like Keith Ellison, the Minnesota Attorney General, why would they want and neck compression in the cause of death? Well, because that's the thing that would tie Floyd's death to Derek Chauvin. So Roger Mitchell calls Andrew Baker, this esteemed medical examiner for Hennepin County, so esteemed, in fact, that Andrew Baker was the youngest ever president of the National Association of Medical Examiners. He's not a young man, but he was so accomplished earlier in his career that he was named the youngest president of that association. And that's how Mitchell knew Baker. They were not friends. They were passing acquaintances. But in any event, Mitchell called Baker, and he told him neck compression has to be in the diagnosis. That's almost an exact quote. And then he also told Andrew Baker, if neck compression is not added to the diagnosis, then I'm going to have to write a critical op-ed and publish it in the Washington Post. That was on Friday, May 29th, 4 days after George Floyd had died, 3 days after Andrew Baker had conducted the autopsy. It should be added that Mitchell never conducted an autopsy himself. He was just reading documents written from afar. The weekend then passes, Saturday and Sunday, and Mitchell calls Baker again on Monday, the 1st of June. And he says to Baker, you know, in effect, like I said, I'm going to publish this op-ed in the Washington Post. And Andrew Baker agrees, having said before that he didn't agree that neck compression needed to be in the diagnosis. Andrew Baker does agree. And then 2 days after that, on June 3rd, at this point, the Attorney General's Office for the State of Minnesota has taken over the case. They upgrade the charges to second-degree felony murder against Derek Chauvin, and they also charge the other three officers. And now Dr. Baker's findings are no longer what he had thought before, cardiopulmonary arrest while being restrained. But this time, the cause of death has changed, and it is now cardiopulmonary arrest complicating law enforcement subdual restraint and neck compression. And that is sort of the very beginning of a series of events that went on for the next 10 or 12 months that just crossed the line into prosecutorial misconduct, egregious, what are called Brady violations, hiding of evidence, influencing witness testimony, and so forth. And I mentioned before I stopped that one of the prosecutors initially on the case had been removed for misconduct. I haven't explained what that misconduct is, and I'm happy to do that if it would be helpful for your audience. But here's something that happened after the fact. Years later, that prosecutor, whose name was Amy Sweezy Tamburino, she had left the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. Hennepin County is where Minneapolis is. And she had brought a civil lawsuit against her former employer, the Hennepin County Attorney, for sex discrimination. And as part of that lawsuit, Ms. Tamburino was being deposed. That means she was giving a statement under oath as part of that civil case. And obviously, this criminal case came up because that's the thing that led to her leaving the office in the first place. And the things that happened specifically on May 25th and May 26th and then up to the 29th came up. and they asked her about Dr. Baker. And at one point in this deposition, Ms. Tamburino said that Baker called her and said, after conducting the autopsy and having seen the developing public narrative, the one that was advanced by Al Sharpton and MSNBC and so forth, and Baker, who has no political affiliation as far as I can tell, said to Amy Tamburino, Amy, what happens when the actual evidence does not match up with the developing public narrative? Then he said, this is the kind of case that ends careers. Now, I do not know how to explain to your audience, given I'm sure that they had various professions and all sorts of different industries, that a statement like this to a prosecutor is like dropping a bomb into the middle of a case. It's what's called Brady material. It must be disclosed to the defense because it tends to show that the defendant is not guilty. You have your lead witness, the man who would become a critical witness, you know, or at least in theory should have been a critical witness, in effect saying that Derek Chauvin did not kill George Floyd and that what everybody thinks happened having watched that four-minute video is not what in fact happened. And as it turned out, the statement was never actually disclosed to the defense. That was one day after George Floyd died. Everything got worse after that.
Is that why she got dismissed? She was the one that got dismissed, right?
She was not dismissed. She was demoted, and then she felt like functionally she was, because she was sidelined, it was the equivalent of a dismissal. And she brought a civil complaint against the city. And she was removed, though. She and three other attorneys were removed from the case. And the reason they were removed was because, and this is another thing that, in a special agent with the FBI or a detective or a prosecutor would know, which is that you do not meet with a witness as a prosecutor, unless, especially an expert witness, unless you have an agent present. And there's procedural reasons for that. But what happened was on May 26th, they received a report from Dr. Baker. So the two lead prosecutors at the time, Amy Sweezy Tamburino and her assistant or her junior colleague, Patrick Lofton, they met with Dr. Baker via video. And you might recall this was in the middle of COVID. And so everybody had sort of adopted, let's do our interviews remotely. It was the rise of the Zoom era and Microsoft Teams and all that. So they met with Baker, with agents present on May 26th, and he told them, in effect, that there was no evidence of asphyxiation, that George Floyd had a lethal dose of fentanyl, that he had severe heart disease capable of causing sudden death. Now, obviously, on May 26th, the world was going crazy. Tamburino later said that the Hennepin County's attorney's office was just pure chaos. And then the message that they're getting from the chief medical examiner for Minneapolis is that this guy didn't kill George Floyd.
Okay.
So the next day is what led to the misconduct. They then decide that they're going to meet with Baker in person. This time, it's not just Ms. Tamburino and Mr. Lofton. It's also the head guy for Hennepin County Attorney's Office, a man named Mike Freeman, and his number two, and a guy named Andy Lefevre. The four of them, all prosecutors, and no agents, no detectives, no sergeants, no law enforcement, no paralegal, no secretaries, nobody else, just prosecutors, go and meet with Baker. This time they do it in person, even though it's in the middle of COVID. And then, like I said, within 48 hours, Mitchell had made the call, and 4 days later, Andrew Baker's cause of death had changed just slightly to add the phrase and neck compression. When the court found out about this meeting, it was stunned. It basically said everything that I've just said. When Judge Cahill found out about this, you know, prosecutors do not meet with witnesses without a witness present, somebody who can corroborate what was said and not said, and he kicked the four of them off the case.
Wow. All right, so what happened with the medical examiner, Andrew Baker? What happened to him?
Well, so ultimately, Andrew Baker played a very interesting role in the trial. It's important to know that, you know, normally in America, all over the country, there are unfortunately murders. And most of those murders are going to be tried at the state level. Most of them are not federal cases. Sometimes they are, but most of them are state cases. And there, the primary witness is going to be the chief medical examiner. And after all, it makes sense, right? If you're the prosecution, you've got to prove that the guy that was killed was killed by the defendant. And so you've got to be able to explain how he died. Your chief medical examiner is going to be the guy who's going to testify to that fact, because he's the one who conducted the autopsy. You could imagine a hypothetical case. Look, the body came in, found a bullet hole. There was a bullet inside the bullet hole, and lo and behold, it matched the firearm that the defendant was carrying. That's just I just made up those facts, but you get the idea. This happens all over the United States every day. The chief medical examiner has to be the prosecution's primary witness, because not only is he an expert, because he's trained in medicine, but he's also a fact witness. He's the one who conducted the autopsy. In this case, Andrew Baker was both an expert and a fact witness. But the problem was that his testimony was still functionally that George Floyd died because he had cardiac arrest and his lungs stopped working because they were filled with fluid. They were what's called edematous. That means full of fluid. They were actually so full of fluid that they weighed 2 to 3 times more than they should have weighed, which is associated with fentanyl overdose. But in any event, that's what Baker's testimony was. So you asked me what happened to Baker. Well, it turns out that the prosecution had to also call about 5 other medical witnesses, which they never would have normally called, except in this case, they needed to explain why Baker was basically wrong. So the prosecution went to trial, in effect, calling its own witness for the purposes of showing that he was wrong or not, at least not totally correct. What then happened was, between the time of George Floyd's death and the subsequent trial the next April, Baker received hundreds, or I think it might have been thousands, I'm not recalling at the moment, of threatening messages at his office, threatening with physical violence and so forth. And so that sort of culture of fear permeated the trial. You know, it was lopsided against the defendant. Anybody who was not going to testify for the prosecution was the subject of threats. And anybody who testified for the defense did, in fact, receive actual physical threats. Attorneys were assaulted in the courthouse. Some witnesses had pig's blood smeared on their homes, and other things like that happened. Baker subsequently went back to his job. The county commission tried to vote him out of the Hennepin County medical examiner's role, but failed, and he's still there today.
Okay. But that he must, it must be very shameful for him, because he sounds like an honest man. It'd be hard to shake that when you know you sent someone to prison. So Derek Chauvin now is, as I understand it, in prison in Arizona. Is that right, Officer Derek Chauvin?
Yes. So after he was convicted in the state trial, he pleaded guilty to the federal civil rights charges. And that is very common when you have the two different governments, the state government and the federal government. When they're charging a person with more or less the same crime, then one of those cases will go forward first, in this case, the state case. And if it results in a conviction, which it did here against Derek Chauvin, then the defendant will oftentimes plead guilty to the federal charges, because if he can strike a deal with federal prosecutors that any sentence that is imposed on the federal crime will run concurrently, which just means at the same time,
right,
as the state crime. So in other words, he won't do any more time. There's no reason to sit through a trial. And in this particular case, it would have the added benefit. It sounds strange to say that it's a benefit, but for many defendants, it is, in fact, an added benefit of going to federal prison instead of state prison. And that's often desirable, because usually federal prisons are safer, cleaner, a little bit more orderly. Some state prisons are a disaster. So unfortunately for Mr. Chauvin, that didn't work out that way. He was subsequently stabbed 22 times by a man who had been an FBI informant. He was not an informant when he stabbed Derek Chauvin. He was an inmate, but he happened to have been an FBI informant in the past. So Chauvin survived this stabbing barely, and since then has not received sufficient medical treatment or physical therapy or rehab associated with the serious injuries that he sustained in that assault.
That is so hard to hear. I think of so many people who've received so much injustice through our courts in the last few years. And I don't want to get off the track here, but like Tina Peters, I've gotten to know Tina. She finally got out of prison, 70 years old, and they gave her a 9-year sentence because she was a Colorado clerk in the election of 2020. That's as far as I'm going to go with that. But she was put in state prison, and she was attacked. You know, here she is at 69 at the time. and could get no protection. The Colorado people hated her, so they did nothing, and the federal court had no jurisdiction. And so so I've been to this rodeo before. But is anyone, lots of us were advocating for Tina, so is anybody advocating for Derek Chauvin?
There are, well, so first of all, I should say that since the book was announced about 2 weeks ago, the increase in public support has been enormous. The book has gotten a ton of attention on Twitter, or for, you know, formerly Twitter, now X. It was reposted by Elon Musk. And the public narrative
great.
Is developing. And, you know, I've been fortunate in that I've been able to help get this message out. But Chauvin is also, he's also represented by an attorney. And the attorney, you know, he had an appeal several years ago. He was represented by a different attorney. That appeal failed at both the federal and state level. Now what he's doing is, again, I won't bore your audience with the procedural technicalities, but it's something called post-conviction relief, which is not exactly an appeal, but it's like it. Suffice it to say that the legal avenues for Derek Chauvin are quite narrow at this point. His best option, and they're not great options, but his best option would be for a federal and a state pardon. He would need both pardons. Obviously, your audience will know that it would be easier in principle to get a federal pardon because Donald Trump is the president. But to get a state pardon, that's not going to happen under Governor Walz in Minnesota. So it would have to be, you know, it would depend in large measure on whoever the next governor of Minnesota is. So he has some narrow legal options, but they're, you know, those opportunities are dwindling fast. The door is not quite closed, but it's close to it. You know, by the way, I should add, if it's all right with you, that
sure.
Remember, I started this by saying that, you know, the whole narrative was that this callously indifferent cop maliciously murdered intentionally a man because he was black. I mean, that was the narrative. That is what Ben Crump, the attorney for George Floyd's family, said. That's what Al Sharpton said. That's what lots in the mainstream media said, including some of the biggest publications in the United States. They said this was about race. They said this was about intentional racism and intentional murder. But that is not at all what the facts showed. So let me say what I mean. First of all, in the United States, we have things called hate crimes, which are different than just a crime. It's, you know, if you just assault somebody, but then if you also assault them because of their race, those are different crimes, and one is considered more serious than the other. In this case, there were no hate crimes charged. The prosecution had no evidence that race played any role at all in the arrest of George Floyd or in the actions of Derek Chauvin. The second thing that you should know is that, and I'm not going to dive into the details here because they're pretty complicated, but suffice it to say that Derek Chauvin was charged with something called second-degree felony murder. The underlying charge, because there has to be an underlying charge for felony murder, is something called assault. And it was an assault because the arrest, according to the prosecutors, started out legitimate and went on too long. And then it became illegitimate. And so, therefore, an assault. The assault then resulted in a death. The death was then a second-degree felony murder. But this is relevant because, remember, the world said that a white man intentionally killed a black man. In closing argument, Steve Schleicher, who was a hired gun brought in from the – I shouldn't say hired gun. He did this work pro bono, but he did not work for the government together with another one of the lead prosecutors. He said in closing more than seven times that the government does not have to prove that Derek Chauvin intended to harm, let alone kill, George Floyd. He went out of his way to say that there is no evidence of intent here. So think, the reason I mentioned that is think about the whole lie, defund the police, Black Lives Matter, America systemically racist. Think about the chaos of the next 4 years politically, about how all of it was built on this narrative of intentionally indifferent racism resulting in murder. And here you have the prosecution that has no evidence of murder, so it cannot even bring hate crime charges at the state or federal level. And here you have a prosecution that tells the jury seven times or more that it does not have to prove that, and did not in fact prove, that Derek Chauvin intended even to harm George Floyd. And here's one last point, and this goes to the thing I raised at the beginning about radical and explosive violence. Everybody says when they see this video, oh, it looks so horrible. And I say, well, let me ask you a question. Did you watch the whole video? Most people say no. But if they did, I say, okay, then you saw the struggle. Any time in that struggle, did you see any of the four officers hit George Floyd? No. Did you see them kick George Floyd? No. Did you see them use an elbow strike against George Floyd? No. Did you see them use any chemical irritants like mace or pepper spray? No. Did you see them tackle George Floyd? No. Did you see them use any strikes at all of any sort against George Floyd's body ever? No. Okay, so let me ask you this. Short of letting George Floyd go, how could they have used less force than they did? I've never heard anybody give an answer to that question because there isn't a good answer. And I want to get into it in a second if you have some time, but talk about use of force a little bit, because what this all does is it goes to show how egregious the prosecution of this man was. To summarize it, they never had intent that Derek Chauvin intended to harm George Floyd. They didn't even bother to try to get it. And they told the jury they didn't have to. They had no intent that any of this was motivated by race. They didn't need it because they didn't have that crime available to them. They had no evidence that Derek Chauvin killed George Floyd by air choking him. The autopsy explicitly proved otherwise. They had no evidence whatsoever that Derek Chauvin killed George Floyd by a blood choke. And then they found out in the middle of trial that it couldn't work. On top of that, there was egregious prosecutorial misconduct beginning the day after the trial. And we've just touched on one of those events, but there were many, many more. And they learned later in the following fall, November of 2020, before the trial began, that a third party named Dr. Mitchell had attempted and succeeded in influencing Dr. Baker's findings about the cause of death. So all of those things, from a prosecutor's perspective, each viewed independently, would be enough for any honest prosecutor to say, this case is finished. We are not bringing it. All of them combined, it's impossible to see past that and to reach any conclusion other than it was politically motivated.
Well, TJ, I can understand why you are such a good attorney, because I love it. I love that you laid this out. And I have a better understanding even then after reading the material and prep for this. So thank you for that. And by the way, the book is called American Scapegoat, How a Corrupt Justice System Sacrificed Derek Chauvin to the Mob. It's not available now in stores, right, TJ? It's going to be released in October?
Correct. You can buy it online from the publisher or on Amazon or, you know, other places where books are sold, but it will be released in October.
Okay. All right. Very, very good. Well, TJ, thank you for so much of your time, and thank you for this book. I mean, isn't it something that I'm just saying, you've written a book that could actually save someone's life and, you know, get them and bring justice. And I hope it does. And if it does, you and I have to talk about that again, okay? Have to talk about it, celebrate together. So
absolutely.
TJ, thank you so much. God bless you for all that you're doing.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. All right. Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Preborn makes it possible for us to have these conversations. And you all, meant so many of you have been faithful donors. Just amazing. You are amazing to me. I would say that, you know, Preborn advertises on almost all the major talk shows and podcasts. And our show performs as well as, from my understanding, most of those major podcasts. And you know why? It's because of you. It's because of you. There are fewer of you, but you give generously and you really believe in saving babies. And so thank you for that. I'm deeply grateful. I'm deeply grateful. And so for just $28, which is the cost of a dinner right now, in most places where most normal people eat, you can sponsor an ultrasound or introduce a mom to her baby for the very first time. And 100% of your donation will go towards saving those babies. Just go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy.
The Sandy Rios 24/7 podcast are available at AFR.net. Back to Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Well,
We have team coverage of this death investigation, starting with Jeff Wagner, who is live at the scene of the protest. And Jeff, that looks like a huge crowd there.
Yeah, what stands out, Amelia, is it is a huge crowd when you also consider the fact that so many people who are here for the protest have actually joined a march towards the Minneapolis Police Department 3rd Precinct, where people here believe the officers involved in that incident who were fired, they worked at 3rd Precinct. So even though a huge majority, a huge portion has already started this march, you can still see a vast crowd here at the intersection of East 38th Street and Chicago Avenue, right outside the Cup Foods location where that arrest happened with George Floyd, where he potentially took his final breaths. We've heard of a lot of emotional people out here today. Chants of, I can't breathe. Chants of, it could have been me. What if it was me? And of course, no justice, no peace. But one thing people have been preaching here is to stay peaceful. On top of that, to stay socially distant, to wear masks. I think what also stands out about the size of this crowd is in the age of COVID-19, in the midst of this pandemic, for so many people to show up in support of George Floyd and the situation that's going on here amidst everything that's happening with the pandemic, I think speaks volumes about the incident that happened here yesterday and how people feel about it.
All right, that was a report from WCCO. And, you know, interesting to kind of throw COVID in the mix, because things were real wacky when that happened, you know. Everybody was kind of out of whack trying to figure that out. But, you know, here's the thing. I have no doubts that there were lots of people in that crowd from Minneapolis who saw the videos and heard the narrative who were genuinely upset by what had happened. And so that is an absolute case. I don't want to diminish that. But it's also true that this really was, it wasn't the real beginning, because I think the St. Louis situation where, what was that, Adam? It's when this black guy, they claimed the police tried to kill him.
Oh, what's his name?
And he had they brought a slogan out of that.
Hands up, don't shoot.
Hands up, don't shoot. Yeah, and what's his name? What was his name?
Brown, wasn't it? Michael Brown.
Did he die?
Yes, he was shot.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. I just got to make sure I have that straight. All right. So what am I saying? I'm saying. Okay. So I think I can do this without and make it work for you. But in addition to all those people who were genuinely concerned and upset, I think what we saw, and now that we're understanding, is that there is a vast group of organizations, lots of them, who have joined in to support these protesters. I should say that differently. To create these protesters, to pay them, to send them in with marching orders, to create slogans. Like, remember in St. Louis, that's the first time we had these kind of riots. It was Michael Brown, and the phrase out of that was, hands up, don't shoot. Hands up, don't shoot. We know now that the police were not responsible. It was not an intentional killing, and yet they were charged with that too. And that was the product of this huge apparatus, this huge machine that has learned how to take advantage of unfortunate incidents wherever. There's one in Dallas now. There's the football player and the young man that stabbed him to death. So, and now that they're getting all these, you know, people so riled up over that, it really is a cottage industry. It's very dangerous. And now when Derek Chauvin had his knee on the neck of George Floyd, the same thing sprung up. And so don't forget that that was part of this. But the one thing I want to say to you, at the beginning of, I did watch it, a big portion, I didn't watch all of it, almost an hour really, of the George Floyd arrest. The things that I noticed were just want to share this. George Floyd had a companion in the car. George Floyd was in someone else's car sitting in the driver's seat. He had another black gentleman in the passenger seat. So there are several, I'm sure, shots of this, but there were two. I watched a video that showed the on the camera on the officers. There's two different ones, so I saw two different officers' perspectives from their camera. So one officer went to the passenger side. He was extremely polite to the passenger. The passenger, a black man, young black man, was extremely polite back, completely cooperative, yes, officer, just like that, just the way it should be for all of us. Doesn't matter what color you are, that's should we how we need to be treating our officers. So he was pretty amazing. Then you go to the other side of the car, the other officer's perspective, and George Floyd is in the driver's seat. Now, that's, we pretty much described, George gets just out of control. And he even says, as I recall, I can't breathe. When Derek Chauvin wasn't holding him down, then this is a long process. He was like, they were trying to get him to get in the back of the police car, and he would not. He wouldn't do it. He was like a madman. And as TJ said, he resisted three different officers. He was just determined. He was extra strong and extra resistant. And still, when you watch the video, the officers are very polite. They're firm. I think you heard enough in the video I played at the beginning to hear that. They never changed. They never treated him with disrespect. They didn't call him any names. They were very patient. They said, no, you're not listening. You have to listen. And then the other thing is, when he actually eventually was down on his side or on his stomach, I guess on his stomach, next to the car, when they finally got him down so they could handcuff him and just try to control him, and Derek Chauvin then put his knee on his right below the base of his neck. And by the way, that is standard procedure. That's what they're taught to do when they can't control someone. But the point I wanted to make was there were a lot of black people around seeing what was happening when Derek Chauvin had his knee on George Floyd, and they were very concerned. Officer, he can't. Officer, he's not even moving. Officer, please let him go. Officer, please. It was like that. There were no pejoratives. There was nothing hateful, just concern. Now, that might have changed later, but that's what I saw in that initial video, like the hour video. And my point is that as from what I saw, if you want to talk about race, the white officers, and it was just one white officer you heard. There was one was half black and one was Hmong, I think it's. One was Hmong, were the Hmong people that a lot of them live in Minneapolis. And so the issue of race is just really moot on this, and for both reasons. The polite white officers and half black and Hmong, and the black, mostly black people standing around watching this happen, all of them polite. And so it's still there in us. I mean, it really is it is still there in us. And that's what we have to move back to is honesty. It has nothing to do with race. And these race baiters like Al Sharpton, they should be run out of town, you know? And Jesse Jackson has just recently passed. He was one of the worst. This just can't be. It just can't be. We have to stop thinking about each other in terms of color because that's what's caused this injustice to Derek Chauvin. So, the book, remember, is called American Scapegoat, How a Corrupt Justice System Sacrificed Derek Chauvin to the Mob. And you can get it, you can pre-order it. So, listen, thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed this. And, you know, Preborn is our sponsor. And if you would like to help them, and I really do hope you will, I know that many of you already are, and thank you for that. Go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. Well, thank you for listening to today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.